Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader here, back once again with one of these remote lockdown specials for Truth in Movies. Tonight, I'm joined by Adam Woodward. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to speak to you.
Oh, it's great to finally have you on because, of course, we've had Hannah, we've had David, we've had Sophie Max Kaufman as well. So now we're just completing the set. How have you been?
Yeah, pretty good, I think, in spite of the circumstances. Keeping busy, watching lots of movies.
Anything you'd recommend?
Well, I did just watch the new Josephine Decker film, Shirley. Oh. And I've had a kind of sneak peek at, and yeah, Hannah has been singing the praises of that one since Sundance back in January.
One of the hotly tipped films of the year.
Yeah, actually really nice to kind of catch up with a new release, because it feels like everything was just wiped off the schedules. And actually I've sort of taken that opportunity to really dive into the sort of annals of cinema, and I've mostly been watching really old movies, actually, from like a lot of stuff from the like 30s and 40s and some good stuff on Mubi and BFI Player and a few other places, so nice to actually watch some new stuff.
Oh, that's terrific. I hope I get some time to watch some new stuff soon. I'm still not really keeping up with any film watching. Still very much watching a lot of CBeebies, which seems to be a thread running through all these pods.
When I spoke to you a few weeks ago, I think you said you hadn't watched a single film.
I think since then I have.
Okay.
I think I rewatched Tokyo Godfathers, the Satoshi Kon anime, a few weeks ago, because I was refreshing my memory of that film. Since then, though, just haven't really had much time to, or maybe I've been instead diving into video games and music, which is actually a good thing, because the topic of this chat tonight is going to be about music, and particularly film soundtracks on vinyl as well. Adam, I think you had this idea for this chat. Can you tell us a bit of the thinking behind it?
Yeah, well, I kind of thought it would be fun to chat to you about, as a fellow wax aficionado. I've been noticing you've been kind of posting your, what you've been listening to on Twitter digging into the vault and playing some really good stuff. I was kind of curious to see, as someone who's a lover of both film and music, how that intersected and whether your collection had much kind of good movie vinyl.
You know, maybe we should just head this off at the pass then, right up front. I don't actually have that many soundtracks in my record collection, even though I love film music and will single out many scores as among my favourite pieces of music of all time. I've just not really got around to getting much of it on vinyl. When you asked me about this the other day, or you seeded this conversation, I went through the racks. I only have maybe 4 or 5 or 6 albums. So when we were thinking of bringing in a show and tell sort of setup, our 3 favourite soundtracks, the pickings were quite slim for me. I think I might as well just say which ones I would highlight out of my collection. I have a really great copy that I've inherited from my dad of Wendy Carlos's soundtrack for A Clockwork Orange, the Kubrick film, which is a bit intense, not necessarily one to listen to all day, every day, but it's a great one that I'm very happy to have there. One album I do return to a lot is the soundtrack for Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive, which is half him and his band Squirrel, which is some great fuzzed out stoner rock, and then half some really nice blissed out garage rock music. And one album I'd shout, I think it might be a bit of a cheat, is one that I have bought recently. One thing that I did, I've been doing over this lockdown period, particularly around Record Store Day, which happened a few weeks ago, but right in the middle of this lockdown, is trying to support independent record stores up and down the country. I bought a really nice copy of Miles Davis's album Jack Johnson.
Oh, nice.
Which is an album that most people don't realise is actually a soundtrack to a film that very few people have seen, the documentary about the boxer. And that is just an incredible album, whether it's married to a film or not.
Mm.
But maybe we'll get into reasons why I don't have many albums as we talk. But did you come with a couple of albums to recommend, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of backtrack slightly, I mean, you say you've got very few in your collection, and it's sort of the same for me. I mean, I'd say overall it probably makes up only like 1 or 2% of everything I have, but they tend to be soundtracks which for me they kind of stand alone from the films. And they're usually for, you know, they're usually from films that I greatly admire and have some kind of personal connection to as well, but you know, there's a lot of, I think there are a lot of really great soundtracks which would probably be quite good to own on record, but I'm not sure I'd ever really be in the mood to play.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones I've kind of picked out, I've sort of veered away from the more obvious stuff, because I do have a couple of sort of classics in there, and also stuff which is perhaps like a great album from a not particularly great film or well known film. Mm-hmm. So. Something like Marvin Gaye's soundtrack to Trouble Man, which is, I think, one of his best records. But like, you know, the film isn't really up to much. So there's a few like that, and a few sort of stranger artifacts, like the Twin Peaks soundtrack, which I think is, you know, again a bit of a classic, but not one I really have the impulse to play much. The ones I picked out, I think they're, weirdly, I've only sort of realised this as we're chatting now, but I think they're soundtracks which I've acquired, you know, at different intervals over the years, but they're all from films that I kind of first watched at quite a formative time. So this would have been, I guess, kind of late college, early university age. When I was really getting into vinyl, especially, and obviously was big into my films, and it was around that time I kind of inherited a lot of records from my dad, who's still very much alive and kicking, but you know, basically just like offloaded a load of his old records onto me, and there's all sorts of stuff in there, and there's kind of regular, it's mostly kind of regular music, not soundtracks, and there's lots of like weird comedy albums and things like that, and like live Monty Python stuff, and but that was like what really, I think, got me into having music on vinyl, and especially reading. I think this is something you don't really get with the CD thing, and something which I, you know, people often talk about the audio quality of vinyl over something like CDs and MP3s, but my first experience is more that I really treasured the tactile, like the physical object of the sleeve, mm-hmm. and like reading the liner notes and you know, production notes and things, and you know, random little etchings that are in the runouts, and mm-hmm. all these kind of hidden Easter eggs and things, which I think, yeah, you don't really necessarily notice in CD format or in any other format. And I think these soundtracks are ones which I just think have really great stories behind them as well. So the first one, which is from one of my top films ever, I think is definitely up in the top 10, is Ry Cooder's score for Paris, Texas.
Brilliant, yeah.
Which is it's obviously a bit of a classic, and I think the director Wim Wenders has described it as being this kind of sacred musical text, and it's just one of those albums that really kind of transports me to a specific time and place. And that isn't a time and place of me kind of watching the film. It's like it really immerses me, I think, in the in the actual like setting of the film. And it's obviously a place I've never visited, but yeah, it's just that slide guitar and is there something very kind of ethereal and almost like existential about it, I think. And yeah, it's just one of those soundtracks that not something I want to listen to kind of every day or even every week, but when you kind of put it on, you know, it's one of those, you gotta kind of turn it up and just like lay down and close your eyes and listen to the whole thing.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, I do love that score. I would like to pick it up someday. It's funny with scores, one other album I do have, which is one I've picked up recently, is the soundtrack to Warren Beatty's film Reds.
Oh, wow.
And I saw that film when I was at university, when it finally came out on DVD over here, I think, in the mid-2000s, and fell in love with... It has basically only two real themes, I think, the entire score. There's one that Stephen Sondheim contributed a song and a theme, and then Dave Grusin did the rest.
Mm.
And when I finally got my hands on the record and played it one evening, I just realised it's actually a bit of a slog of an album to listen to because it's just rearrangements of the same theme over and over. And that's almost a problem I have with many traditional scores, is if it's a film where there is a handful of key themes and leitmotifs, you're in for listening to them over and over. Whereas something, one album I would love to buy someday is Jim Jarmusch's, the soundtrack for Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man, the Neil Young score. I know some listeners tweeted at us saying that they have that as a pride in their collection. And that's just something where you can really sink yourself into this improvised piece of, I think it's harmonium and guitar, that Neil Young composed while watching the film. And you'll probably never get bored and it'll never be predictable. The reason why I have so few records, soundtrack records, that is because when I started collecting in earnest a few years ago, I set myself some strict rules because otherwise I'd just buy everything and give myself over to impulse. So I set myself quite a strict maximum price, that I wouldn't pay over a certain amount for records. And also I would only pick stuff up that I'd find by chance in record stores. I've only recently broken that when I've started buying stuff online. And that's probably why I have such a random collection. Also probably what stopped me from getting some of these Lux reissues that Death Waltz or Mondo put out, which are just absolutely gorgeous. And the vinyl's coloured, the packaging is immaculate, they have, you know, special artwork, but they are a little bit pricey. Do you have many of those, Adam?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm a sort of bit of a snob when it comes to things like these special-ish editions and things which are, you know, things like Record Store Day have obviously been co-opted by the sort of major labels now. And obviously it's still a great initiative and does support independent record stores. But I mean, I remember being in a store local to me a couple of years back, and it was like the day before Record Store Day. And one of the members of staff was just unloading a box filled with, like, you know, picture discs of like the Space Jam soundtrack or something, which had been reissued. And it was probably going for like 30 quid or something. And it's just one of those... one of those things is a bit of a purist. I mean, I totally get, I think that's setting those parameters as you have. I totally get that, you know, one of the beautiful things about collecting, and I'm not a really avid collector, but I think one of the great things is that discovery element and really, you know, crate digging and that moment when you kind of find something that you've been looking for. Or I don't know if you keep a physical or like a mental list of stuff, but I've often got a few things jostling around in the back of my mind when I'm looking through crates and in dusty old record shops. And I'd much sooner have that moment of discovery than queue up to part with my hard-earned coin for some kind of, you know, limited release that's pressed on like mega heavyweight vinyl and coloured and essentially something which looks cool but you don't really ever want to play.
Yeah, I absolutely do have a list like that. And in fact, I wonder if it was actually captured on our Rotterdam podcasts, but Rotterdam, when we were out there for the film festival earlier in the year, seems like years ago now, Rotterdam has really great record stores, and David and I, maybe in between screenings, went for an hour, went off down the road that all the record stores were on, and I found some records I've never seen over here that have been on that list for ages. I think one of them was the album Wish You Were Here by Badfinger, which was issued over here and in the States, but they had a problem with the record label, something about contractual disputes, so the album was pulled quite quickly, and it's an amazing record. It's finally been reissued now, but I really wanted an actual pressing from way back when. And I went up to the desk and said, oh, you know, I've been looking for this in London for so long, I've never seen it before, it's great. And the guy just sort of like rolled his eyes and went, yeah, whatever. One person's discovery is another person's ballast, I guess.
I've got to say, actually, one of the real perks of this job is or a sort of add-on, I guess, is like anytime I go to a new city for like a film festival, and Rotterdam's a great example, but I was thinking of a couple of years ago, I went to quite a small documentary festival in Porto. And I'll always carve out time over the course of that, you know, weekend or whatever to check out the local record stores. And that's always like a real treat, I think, just seeing. I mean, that, you know, record stores, especially secondhand record stores, they're all kind of the same in a way. There's like a real, you know, there's like a familiarity there, I think. Even if you go to quite a specialist one, just the feeling, the atmosphere, I think, is often quite similar, and there's something quite comforting about that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So you gave us the first album. Want to give us the second?
Yeah, these are kind of picked out quite randomly, I must say, but I've played them all again, and they're records that I just think really hold up now. The second one is Carter Burwell's soundtrack to the Coen Brothers' Miller's Crossing from 1990, which I think is his. I think it's like the second or third score he did for them. His first ever score was Blood Simple, which is obviously Joel Coen's directorial debut as well. So they kind of go way back, and he's still, I think he did Hail Caesar. He's kind of still doing films with them now. But I think Miller's Crossing was the first time he'd ever worked with an orchestra and actually written an orchestral composition. And it's just like a really beautiful, I don't know how recently you've seen Miller's Crossing, but it's a really kind of brutal film. I mean, you know, the Coen brothers often do blend tragedy and comedy and light and dark. And this is like a really pretty unrelentingly heavy going thing. And the score just adds this lightness, and a real kind of, there's a real like humanity in the score as well. Like it feels like there's something, it's like a connection to something very, very soulful and very human. And I remember we did a really, really fascinating interview with Carter Burwell a couple of years ago, and he sort of spoke about the inspiration for various soundtracks that he's worked on. And he was sort of saying that this, he'd seen the film, it was like a rough edit with no music. I don't think there was even any temp music on it. And he was really struck by how kind of brutal and cold it was. And he wanted to do something quite warm. And apparently Joel Cohen, his note back to him was, could you do something quite hard and cold? And so they went with something a bit more neutral. But it's a really amazing score. It's made up of this, you know, it's predominantly kind of folky, or more of a kind of folky orchestral sound. And there's a couple of old Irish folk ballads on there, sung by Frank Patterson, who's like a famous kind of Irish tenor. One of which is Danny Boy, which is just, you know, absolutely destroys me every time I kind of listen to that. And it's just like a really beautiful piece of music, and I think really evocative of the period as well. This kind of jazzy Prohibition era, there's something really romantic and nostalgic and almost like dreamlike about it.
Yeah, the Coen brothers, their soundtracks are really great. They really know their music, particularly their films, which are either set in a certain period or have a certain protagonist who they want the soundtrack to reflect. So, well, The Big Lebowski wasn't vinyl, it was CD back then, but that was a big soundtrack for me and my friends at a certain age. Certain tracks on that really burned into the consciousness.
Oh yeah, I mean, they're one of those, I think they're sort of jukebox soundtracks, especially Big Lebowski, there's a few others, but they're some of those songs are just so synonymous. You almost like can't disassociate the song from that film now. There's a few on there. I mean, in the same way that Quentin Tarantino has this knack of being able to kind of reclaim these almost like forgotten pop artifacts, I think the Coen brothers do that really well.
And then there's Inside Llewyn Davis, which is an amazing performance score of original songs.
Yeah, I was gonna include that actually in this little chat, and I've got a sort of 10-inch of that, and I think it's Oscar Isaac actually performing with the matey from Mumford and Sons, and the original songs for that I think, and on a par with that is Alex Turner's soundtrack to Submarine. Are you a fan of that?
Oh right, that was an EP, wasn't it? There wasn't much on that. Yeah,
it's like four or five tracks I think, but that again is like, I think those two in terms of like more recent ones, but they're very much rooted in a more kind of traditional style of music, I think. They're amazing.
What was your third one, Adam?
Third one is, and I think this will appeal to you particularly, is Goblin's soundtrack and slash score to Dawn of the Dead, which notoriously was kind of recut for European release by Dario Argento. And I think if you've ever seen the US version, which of course George A. Romero has his kind of name top billing on, that film is much more, I think with a lot of Romero films, when you watch them back you kind of pick this up, but there's a lot more kind of humor in that cut, and he's a real big fan of like library music. Obviously his films feature a lot of that predominantly, and this one Argento basically like stripped all that back, and you know he was like a Goblin and him obviously go way back, and they'd kind of, I think this was like deep into their relationship working with him, and so he understandably really elevates their music on this film, and it's a weird soundtrack. The version I've got of it is I think it's a reissue from like the early 2000s, so it's not the original 1978 version. I think it's got a couple of extra tracks which were included on this particular release, because they wrote a load of music which basically like isn't included on the soundtrack on the actual film on either version, and it's just this really kind of bonkers, extremely eclectic soundtrack. Opens with like a very very distinctive Goblin-esque you know, horror, you know, slow, eerie synths, lots of like choral vocal sounds. There's a sort of like cold fog descending as you start listening to it. And then it kind of just goes off in so many random, wonderful directions. And, you know, it's like Goblin started off as like a prog rock band, and there's kind of some prog stuff in there. And there's one song which is like a kind of 1920s ragtime tune. There's one like weird kind of, it's almost like African drum beats and like weird, exotic, like tribal sounds, which is, I don't think has aged particularly well. At times it's like they're just throwing anything at the wall and seeing what sticks. But it's one of those things where, I sort of mentioned earlier, sometimes I have to be in the right mood to listen to a certain piece of music. And especially, I think that's especially true of film scores.
Mm-hmm.
But with this, I mean, it caters for every possible mood you could be in. So it's actually a really interesting listen. And you kind of, you know, Even though I'm quite familiar with it now, I've listened to it, you know, many times. Every time I put it on, I'm sort of rocked by like what comes on next, and can never quite remember the order of the sequence. And it's certainly not a soundtrack to just kind of sit and lull away the time listening to, because it really does, you know, grab your attention. In I suppose that was the intent of it, but it's a really quite bizarre and quite brilliant work, I think.
Oh yeah, and their earlier soundtracks, like with Deep Red, etc. Really great. And a lot of that stuff, a lot of the Italian horror movie or European 70s kind of movie soundtracks are now the sort of thing that gets these luxury issues. It's crazy, probably, for someone who was a fan in the 80s or 90s, where this stuff was really hard to get hold of. There's a really good line of compilations I'll tip the hat to, called Vault of Horror. I think they're like 2 or 3 volumes in now, and they are like they really just find the all these themes from these deep cut cult horror movies, from European horror movies, and they've got an amazing liner notes by Alan Jones, you know, the horror movie expert who's one of the co-directors of Fright Fest. I've got one of those, and you have to be in a certain frame of mind, because it's this heady mix of psychedelic, jazz, world music, freak out stuff, as well as very abrasive avant-garde classical, and easy listening thrown in for good measure sometimes. But it's mind-bending stuff.
I think there's a lot of stuff from that time, which especially European stuff, which was, you know, not even issued on vinyl sometimes, or if it was, it was bootlegged, or they were kind of unofficial releases. And I remember there's one of my kind of go-to and most like treasured record shops is a place in Brighton where I lived for a short time, and it's right by the train station, if you've ever been there, called the Record Album, which back in the day, I lived in Brighton for a short time, and I would go in there at least kind of once a week and bother the old guy who ran it. And this is kind of going back a few years, so I'm not even sure if I think it's open still, operating, but I'm not sure whether he's still running it. But it's been there for like forever. And it is, I mean, if you're into movie soundtracks especially, but just any kind of old, obscure, you know, they've got lots of like library music and weird and wonderful stuff. And that's where I picked up a lot of this stuff, including the Dawn of the Dead soundtrack, actually.
Hmm.
And they've got some incredibly rare, a lot of like old European horror soundtracks, like exploitation movies. It's a real treasure trove of stuff. So I definitely recommend people check that out if you get the opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. Should we look at some of these listener contributions? So we put out a tweet saying we were going to talk about film soundtracks on vinyl that were close to our hearts, and listeners, of course, chimed in with some incredible finds here.
Yeah, I saw one. I got to say, as much as I've outed myself as a vinyl snob and been quite dismissive of these swanky reissues and special editions, I think someone posted a picture of the soundtrack to the Safdie Brothers Heaven Knows What, which is pressed on this kind of bright pink vinyl, and it's cut into the shape of like a Ninja Death Star, which is is quite an amazing object. Again, not really sure it's one of those I'd ever want to really play, and I can't really think what the music in heaven knows what is actually, but that is pretty amazing.
It really is, and I suppose it feeds into this sense of it's the physical object. And nowadays, maybe our relationship with films is so distant. You go and see a film, maybe we don't necessarily buy it on DVD or Blu-ray if you're not a disc-based media person, if you instead stream things. And so you want to be able to have something in your home that says, that displays your love of a film, your attachment to a film. And gosh, that is really cool. That suggestion came from Rue Lambruso. God, yeah, heaven knows what EP, Aerial Pink and Blood Orange, that's Pink Ninja Star. But there are people here really putting us to shame. Some amazing collections here of classic stuff. Emma Fraser sent us a picture of her you know, stuff from her dad's record collection, High Society, Thunderball, I Walk the Line, Johnny Cash, some really great stuff. And I think whenever I go digging in record stores, that's the sort of stuff I end up kind of like flicking through is scores from the 60s or 70s. Mm-hmm. The one that I have come very close to buying a couple of times from my local record store down here in South London, they've got a really great copy of the soundtrack to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which is such an absolute barnstormer of a soundtrack and would be really fun to put on. Any time of day if you just want, you know, a kick up the backside. But I need to shout out Sam Clements here. I think we mentioned him on a previous podcast, but he is, out of many people I know, somebody who really goes for film soundtracks. In fact, most of his vinyl collection is film soundtracks. He sent a picture of just the pile, which seems to be filling his entire room. Highlights including a picture disc of the Moana song soundtrack. But some real nice cuts here, like the soundtrack to the Ghibli film My Neighbor Totoro, as well as 20th Century Women, and an amazing score for the anime Your Name. And that they're scores where you go and watch a film like Your Name, and you come out and you think, I need to hear those songs again. And maybe that's the impulse that leads you straight to the online store where you can order them. That's the probably the same impulse that when I was a teenager and I think, you know, the first Quentin Tarantino film I saw in the cinemas was Kill Bill Volume 1. And it's impossible to come out of seeing that film as an impressionable youngster and not immediately think I need to hear that soundtrack again, because that has like 7 or 8 standout song sequences. And again, as you said, Tarantino is the great tastemaker who finds these obscure covers or obscure forgotten songs and blows your mind with them.
I think what I tend to do is, like, rather than buy the soundtrack to like a Tarantino film, I'll track down the songs I like and then try and find copies of the album those songs feature on or featured on originally.
Mm.
So, you know, I'll be like looking out for some like old Nancy Sinatra or Paul Revere and that kind of stuff. It's like stuff actually, which probably, for the most part, you know, you're not going to play it a lot, and there's maybe like one or two tracks you'll actually like, and would make more sense to actually just invest in the album. But I kind of like listening to things in their original context as well, I guess.
That's true. Although I'm a great believer in the compilation as a cultural force. Recently, I've mentioned this on the podcast before, during this time of lockdown, I feel like I've been regressing into my teenage self, and I've been listening to music and going back into obsessions that I've not really looked at in 20 plus years. And in the process, I've been thinking about how important compilations were in shaping my music taste. Like, what I posted on Twitter the other day was a 2-disc album called The Greatest Air Guitar Album Ever. And looking at that now, I think I was maybe 12 when that came out, maybe 13. All of my favourite songs circa that time were on this album, and I'd never heard so many of the bands on there. And then, yes, that did then filter out, and I followed the bands separately, or the artists separately. But I really think that a very well curated jukebox soundtrack can go a long way.
Yeah, I think it depends on what the album is, and I think Tarantino or the Coen brothers, they just had a tastes that kind of correlate very much with my own, and it's more again trying to get, even at second hand, trying to tap into that idea of discovery and going out myself and trying to find this stuff.
What sort of a listener are you, Adam? When you like pull out a record, what do you look for?
I tend to sort of pull stuff out, put it on, sit down, you know, listen to it. If it's something that I know really well and is something that I've had for a long time, then I'll tend to just kind of let it play and not really kind of think about anything else, and, you know, not really even kind of study the sleeve or anything. If it's something new, then I'll maybe do that. I want to just find out more information about it. And sometimes I'll kind of listen to stuff and actually start sort of Googling about the backstory of it, or, you know, finding out about the artist and stuff. I kind of like reading musical biography stuff, mostly online, while I'm listening. But yeah, tend to basically just listen to stuff with nothing else happening other than me basically in the room with the music. And I'm like a no skips guy as well. I can hold my hand on my heart and say I don't think I've ever... I saw this was like a big discussion on Twitter recently of like what albums have like no skips. And I thought, wow, I honestly don't think I've ever skipped a song on an album. Listened to like the single version. But once I've actually like put a piece of music on, you know, what an album's what, like 30, 40 minutes or something? So there's that. But I think the vinyl thing for me, especially regarding film soundtracks, is, and this is a shocking confession perhaps to make, but I don't actually own, in terms of physical media, that's kind of it for me. Like, I don't own any DVDs or Blu-rays or anything like that. You know, obviously there is like a world of cinema online. We're especially grateful for when you're not able to actually go out and go to the cinema. But I guess my sort of preferred, you know, environment for actually consuming and enjoying cinema is going to the cinema, right? Mm-hmm. But in terms of music, it is like putting on, although I've obviously got like Spotify and I'll kind of, you know, trawl through YouTube for like weird stuff that's not on there or other platforms. The kind of ultimate listening experience for me is putting something on my record player and actually just sitting and listening to it.
Oh, and is it a solitary thing, or do you have housemates around while you're doing it?
No, not always. I mean,
compromise.
Not always. My partner is, you know, there's lots of stuff that she really loves from my collection, and actually, like, a lot of it's hers as well. We've got pretty similar tastes. I mean, there's some stuff which I tend to only put on when she's out. You know, she won't really abide my reggae and other stuff. But yes, film soundtracks. I think that's a kind of weird one, because I don't really actually have that many film soundtracks. So they are a kind of strange thing, because I think unless you know the film that it's from particularly well, there maybe aren't that many that you could just put on as a piece of music and kind of appreciate just purely on their own terms. Or obviously you can do that, but I guess it doesn't have the same... You know, might not have the same connection with you.
It's interesting you say that. You know, my home listening setup is that I do have to compromise with the tastes of my partner, but also the baby, who maybe doesn't want to have records on all day long, would rather listen to Baby Shark instead. But that little bit of time in the evening we have together, if we want to put a record on, it's very important we pick the right thing. So maybe no Black Sabbath. So, not necessarily soundtracks, but this sort of space of modern classical, where, you know, a lot of these guys have worked in film soundtracks. You think of Max Richter or Johan Johansson. There's a really great, to go back to compilations, there's a really great disc we have which Deutsche Grammophon put out a few years ago called Expo One, which was almost their statement on what modern day classical orchestral music was. And it's a label sampler, so it has all sorts of stuff, but it does have a piece from the There Will Be Blood soundtrack, the Johnny Greenwood score. It does have a lot of Johan Johansson and Max Richter in there as well, but they're actual albums sound like film scores anyway, and many of their original pieces would be excerpted and used in film and TV. Do you have any soundtracks that you'd still like to get someday that you've not got in your collection already, Adam?
Oh, there's loads. I mean, I actually got rid of a load a few years back because they were ones that were sort of classic film scores that I just sort of thought, well, I'm never going to listen to this, you know. A lot of stuff from like the 60s and 70s, nothing particularly exciting or rare or valuable or anything like that. As I say, I've sort of really kept on to and clung on to the stuff which, for whatever reason, and this is something I've only really come to realise, I guess, after the fact, or it's something subconscious really, but I've really kept on to the stuff which I have more of a personal connection to the film itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a recent example, actually, you just mentioned Johnny Greenwood, and I think his Phantom Thread soundtrack, I think it is like one of the most amazing pieces of modern classical music. And that was one that, I think the first time I saw the film, and actually we're extremely lucky to go to, the performance with the live score that he conducted with, at the Royal Festival Hall. And, had kind of like front row seats for that, and that was kind of amazing. I'd seen the film a couple of times by that point, so it was a real, I was really able to just sort of let myself be immersed in the music and concentrate on that. And that was one I sort of had to, as soon as that came out on vinyl, I was kind of straight there. So there's a few like that, but as I say, it tends to be the stuff which, you know, has some kind of like formative relationship with.
Well, I was looking at my want list or to buy list, and it's growing now with some of the suggestions from listeners that they've been sending in. But Phantom Thread, I would love to own that someday, and I think it forms a brilliant yin yang with the You Were Never Really Here soundtrack that Johnny Greenwood did just beforehand. A very different vibe, but another beautiful score. And then I also really love the soundtrack to If Beale Street Could Talk, a really great melancholic jazz based soundtrack. And it's a very beautiful cover that they put on the vinyl release as well. I'd love to get those someday. But really, for me, it is just this sense of utility. Whenever I'm there in a record store looking at these albums, sometimes it's the thrill of discovery, as we said, but sometimes it's just, will I listen to this? On a Thursday evening, the baby's in bed, and I'm looking at my partner, she's looking at me, and I'm like, what are we going to listen to now? Am I going to pull out the score for Uncut Gems and completely ruin our mood for the evening, or what? Because that's a score that I know a lot of people really do love, and that's one that I could never think about listening to outside of the context of the film.
Are there any other contexts or situations where you would put on a film soundtrack? Like maybe if you were like, you know, out running or on the move in some way, or?
I first of all, I don't run. not an exercise fiend. I know people who listen to massive playlists of soundtracks when they're working, when they're writing, because it's not primarily vocal or lyric based, but it does have this sense of dynamics and drive. That's not, no, I listen to band based music all day long instead. There's just too many other genres out there to go and explore.
I think that's mostly true for me. I mean, you know, when I'm like in secondhand record shops, and I think the soundtracks section will be like the last place I look or go to, because there are 100 other things or artists or genres that I'll be more interested in at any given time. Mm. And I go through phases of picking up stuff. In fact, one of the reasons I actually got rid of a lot of stuff a few years ago was for space more than anything. Mm-hmm. Just decluttering and, you know, giving something to a better home, and someone actually will get some use out of it. But yeah, I think I'm definitely not hooked on specifically film soundtracks in the same way I am with other artists and genres and just kind of vinyl, I suppose, generally. And it's weird. There isn't really a rhyme or reason to the. I mean, I guess the three that I've picked out for discussion, here, they're all quite different. I don't think there's a real. Mm. Apart from the personal connection I have with the films and the material, I think that, you know, they don't really conform to a specific style or genre.
No. I suppose to wrap up, it would be good to just include a few more suggestions from friends and family. We did ask David and Hannah what their key albums were, if they were going to suggest a handful. Hannah did mention You Were Never Really Here, the Johnny Greenwood soundtrack, but also a soundtrack that I think is very pivotal to many people of a certain age, the soundtrack for Drive.
Mm.
Of course, again, an album that's great for capturing a certain genre at a certain moment in musical history. But then also Hannah has the soundtrack for Her Smell, which I still haven't got around to seeing. I can't wait to watch it. And I hear that the songs are pretty good on that soundtrack.
That's an interesting one, because I'm pretty sure it's all original, you know, songs. The band within the film are performing obviously their own original songs, which were written for the film. And that's a really good shout, actually.
And David had The Young Girls of Rochefort, the Michel Legrand soundtrack.
Yeah.
He called it his spiritual guiding light, which is very Davey.
Nice, yeah.
And you were saying how soundtrack albums that sometimes you can't just put on in the background and let wash over you. Phil Olsen on Twitter sent in a picture of his very beautiful copy of the soundtrack to Moon, the Clint Mansell score, which I think is one, because it's a post-rock type soundtrack. Yeah. You could just have on in the background.
Do you think there are some bands who... And you're someone, as you said, who sort of gravitates more towards groups, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are some artists and bands whose film work slots in very neatly with the rest of their discography, right?
Yeah.
And you could kind of happily, you know, have something, you could pick something out and not even think about it in terms of it being a piece of film work.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think the artists I've mentioned, I don't think I have any other work by them. I don't have any other Rai Kuda albums, although he's made, you know, tens and tens of records.
Mm.
And I've listened to some and will consider myself a kind of fan of his stuff generally. That is like the only one I actually own. So yeah, I think there's a bit of a distinction between, there's so many great bands who've made great film records or film music. I guess they're not the ones I kind of think of first and foremost.
Right.
When we're discussing this stuff.
Well, because I'd probably say that the Mogwai albums that I listen to the most nowadays are their soundtracks. Their soundtrack to the TV series Les Revenants is, you know, one that I return to often, much more than their classic albums earlier in their career.
Oh yeah.
And I heard someone recently going very hard for the Pink Floyd soundtracks they did earlier in their career, which often get forgotten about.
Yeah, I was thinking about Pink Floyd and the Kinks and those bands, and it's so many bands of that period obviously made, you know, did original compositions for films.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose a lot of them, the music has kind of aged better than the films. We're certainly more renowned today, but I guess because of the legacy and the, you know, the reputation of the bands and the artists. But And David Bowie, someone we mentioned earlier, is another one. The Beatles being one, I guess you could kind of say things like Help and A Hard Day's Night. They are kind of technically film soundtracks, but I wouldn't count them in this sort of conversation.
Oh, so then would you count The Graduate soundtrack?
Yeah, I was thinking about that and Pat Garrett as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, another shocking confession, I'm very much not a Bob Dylan fan. But I think Pat Garrett is just a genius, basically, and it's interesting. I suppose you do have to include them, but The Graduate's one of those I think I got rid of, actually. I think it was one of those kind of totemic classic soundtracks that I picked up because I felt like it was one that any aspiring record collector and movie fan had to really have, and yeah, I just felt that I didn't really have any connection to it. I mean, I like the film and like the music a lot, but again, it just didn't, you know, it was quite an easy one for me to cast off, I think, in the end.
Is Simon and Garfunkel a group that you have other albums by, or is that the only one?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm sure I do have. I've probably got like Bridge Over Troubled Water or something. I'm a Simon fan. I'm a Graceland fan, but I'm not as much of the two.
You see, this is getting off topic slightly, but Simon and Garfunkel are one of those acts that I say they have the greatest hits that are as good as any of their individual albums in terms of uniformity and a single work. Mm. And weirdly, they all seem to be on Columbia. So it's like Simon Garfunkel, Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan all released single disc greatest hits within the first handful of years of their careers that just stand up now as single units side by side with their original albums.
Yeah. There's one actually which I haven't mentioned, which is the Quadrophenia soundtrack,
right?
Which is it falls into a kind of strange category in that it is obviously the film kind of came after the music,
mm-hmm.
So it's obviously a sort of rock opera double album, you know, conceived by Pete Townsend and I love the film as well, but the music and The Who especially were a band that my dad, you know, they're kind of one of his favorite bands who he saw live a few times, and so I kind of grew up listening to them a lot, and the Quadrophenia soundtrack, that's one I kind of inherited off him, but that is one of those I don't really kind of associate it with the film, I suppose. Although it is obviously very cinematic, and you kind of listen to it and it puts you in that headspace, but that's just one of those that I absolutely love the music first and foremost. One I wouldn't really have thought otherwise to sort of include in this discussion.
Yeah, so many different types of film soundtrack out there. I think we've covered many of them, haven't we, Adam?
It's a pretty broad church. I mean, I'd love to hear, if listeners, you know, want to get in touch with some suggestions, and maybe there's some other strange crossovers and, you know, other sort of definitions of the movie soundtrack that we haven't really covered here. But
listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this discussion on movie soundtracks and vinyl. Please do send us in your recommendations, your tips, maybe record stores we should check out, the usual channels, at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or at the comments section at lwlies.com/podcast. Adam, thank you so much for nerding out with me this evening, talking about vinyl. I'm Mike Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.